I'm John Kroll. Today on No Limits, we're going to continue our conversation about the tumultuous first days of the Trump presidency. We will discuss the president's executive order and rhetoric regarding immigration. My guests are Cole Varga, Exodus Refugee Immigration, Elizabeth Cullen Dunn, Associate Professor of Geography and International Studies with Indiana University, and Rachel Van Tile, Immigration Attorney with Neighborhood Christian Legal Clinic. Please join the conversation. Call 866-476-3881. Email nolimits@wfyi.org. Facebook is No Limits WFYI. Twitter is WFYI. Now, this news. Welcome to No Limits. I am John Kroll, director of Franklin College's Pulliam School of Journalism, publisher of thestatehousefile.com, and your host. We're going to be continuing our conversation today about these event-filled first days of the Trump presidency. On Tuesday, obviously, we were talking about activism and the women's marches. Today, we're going to talk about the president's executive order regarding immigration and his rhetoric regarding immigration in general. If you'd like to join the conversation, please give us a buzz at 866-476-3881. You can send us an email at nolimits@wfyi.org. You can find us on Facebook at nolimitswfyi or on Twitter at wfyi. My guests are Cole Varga, who is with Exodus Refugee Immigration, Elizabeth Cullen Dunn, who is Associate Professor of Geography and International Studies with Indiana University, and Rachel Van Tile, who is an immigration attorney with Neighborhood Christian Legal Clinic. Welcome, all of you.
Thanks for having me.
It's good to have you here. So I'm going to start first, and I think I'll throw this one to Rachel. Can you walk us through exactly what the executive order said? Because even that has become a subject of some dispute.
Sure. Yeah. So the executive order was issued on January 27th, 2017, last Friday at about 4:40 in the afternoon. It's called Protecting the Nation from Foreign Terrorist Entry into the United States. It suspends refugee admission for 120 days. It drops the refugee admissions, which have been at 110,000, down to 50,000. And it is creates an indefinite suspension of all Syrian refugees until the president decides that there's sufficient changes have been made to let the Syrian people back in. Ban on or a bar for 90 days for people from 7 countries, including Iraq, Iran, Libya, Somalia, Sudan, Syria, and Yemen, and leaves open the possibility to add additional countries to that list. And within 30 days, those countries must show that they're creating steps to vet their people before they can come into the U.S. So that's kind of the big points there.
And since then, I mean, the president said in his announcement that it was a ban, but many of his spokespeople, Cole, you're nodding your head, so I'll throw this one to you next. Many of his spokespeople or advocates have since said, oh, no, it's not a ban. So I'm going to ask all three of you here, but I'll start with Cole. Is it a ban or is it not?
In terms of refugee admissions, it pauses all refugee admissions for 120 days, but effectively there is a ban on Syrian refugees for the foreseeable future.
Elizabeth?
It's not just a ban on Syrians either. It's a ban on Sudanese. It's a ban on Somalias, on Somalians. And between those three countries, that is over half of the world's refugee population. These are the three of the four largest refugee-producing countries in the world.
So, Rachel, I'll let you have a word on this,
oh,
too.
Yes.
Is it a ban or is it not?
Yes, I think certainly in the way it is put in, it is a ban. Whether or not they want to use that word, I guess, is up to them. But
yeah, blue is still blue, regardless
right,
of whether
exactly.
you call it whatever. What problem, and I'm asking you to sort of step aside, what problem was this executive order attempting to solve? Elizabeth, I'll start with you.
It's not attempting to solve an actual problem. It's attempting to solve what is an irrational fear, actually, which is the notion that refugees might come in and have an attack on American soil, as has happened in Europe. What's really important to know about that is that none of these countries that are on the seven countries prohibited have ever had produced someone who has carried out an attack against Americans on the United States. And the other thing that's really important to know is that our system is so different than Europe's that there's no way that someone who is unvetted, uncleared, could come into the United States via the refugee channel. So it's not like Germany where people were coming in first and then being vetted. Here we do all that vetting overseas before they arrive.
And I can kind of jump onto that. Throughout the campaign, Donald Trump mentioned this extreme vetting, whatever that means to him. But I would say for those of us who know what the screening process is, we're already in a place where extreme vetting exists. The U.S. screening process for refugees is the most rigorous screening process for any entrant coming into the country. It takes typically 18 to 24 months to get through all of the steps, all the interagency checks, which include the FBI, the DOD, Department of Homeland Security. It's really a brutal process. And talking to some of my my clients that I serve at Exodus and that have been through this, it's extensive.
We are talking about the immigration controversy here on No Limits. If you'd like to join the conversation, you can send us an email at nolimits@wfyi.org. You can find us on Facebook at No Limits WFYI, on Twitter at WFYI, or you can do what a listener named Ron has done and give us a call at 866-476-3881. Ron, welcome to the program.
Hello, John. Thanks again for the show, as usual. My interest, curiosity is, you know, I tend to look at the bottom line, the connecting the dots, and Bernie Sanders, Senator Sanders, alluded during his campaign that much of the influx of immigrants has to do with climate change. And I'm wondering if we're seeing the same process as we saw during the Irish potato famine when people had nothing to eat. And they didn't want to leave their home countries, but they had to. And I'm wondering if that's what we're seeing today, and how much of that. And here Mr. Trump and his friends are profiting from refusing to believe in climate change. And from what I can see, as land shrinks, as the icebergs melt, it's only going to get worse. So somebody has to do something. Thanks. I'll take my answer or
certainly
comments off the air.
Certainly.
Thank
Thanks very much for the call, Ron. Elizabeth.
Sure. You know, the number of refugees and internally displaced people, that is people who've been forced out of their homes but haven't left the country of origin yet, has been just skyrocketing over the last 25 years. We've gone from, in 1989, about 9 million displaced people to almost 66 million displaced people around the world today. And a lot of that is sort of in the immediate sense triggered by the upswing in civil wars. But it's really clear that climate change is changing the composition of these societies, forcing lots of people off agricultural land and into the cities, and that's creating social tensions that are an underlying cause of civil war. So I think that it's not just that what we've seen now is a result of climate change, but we're going to see over the next 10 years a real upswing in people around the world being forced to move because their homes are being affected by changes in the climate.
This is, and Indiana at some level got a taste of this before the rest of the nation. I mean, along with a lot of other states, then governor, now vice president, Mike Pence, made a decision to ban refugees from Syria to Indiana. And that issue was litigated. Correct, Rachel, and I know
yes.
Exodus called both of them.
This was our case,
yes.
Along with our friends over at the ACLU, that successfully fought back that directive.
I should step in and do my standard disclosure here. For 6 years, I was the executive director of what is now the ACLU of Indiana. I don't like to withhold that from, but please continue, Cole.
Yes, so Pence's decision-making on Syrians started back here in Indiana in November 2015, and we immediately took action with our friends at the ACLU to file a lawsuit in federal court. It was misguided at the time, and the policy still is, to ban one group of people based on their nationality or their religion is simply un-American.
Rachel, is there case law? in regard to these executive orders regarding immigration?
Well, certainly it flies in the face of the Constitution, which says that nobody can be barred based on a protected group, which would be religion or national origin. And I think Judge Posner made that quite clear in his oral argument or oral decision in the case, that there really is no basis other than fear here, which is not a basis for keeping a group of people out.
Right. And I think there's a lot of misunderstanding about just who refugees are. Refugees are persecuted people who have not decided to move to the United States or Europe or anywhere else. They have been forced out of their homes. It is not their choice to leave. It's sort of their last resort.
I would like to throw in one thing here, is that if you were thinking of planting a terrorist sleeper cell or something in with refugees, it makes no sense to come in through the refugee channel. Mm-hmm. Because we take so few of the people who apply. We take less than 0.2% of the people who applied to come to the United States with refugee status. And then at that point, they're waiting 18 to 24 months. So it's unlikely that a terrorist organization would hope that whoever they planted would be in that tiny fraction of people and would get here within any reasonable time. This is just not a channel that makes sense to use for those purposes. So we don't have any reason to believe that refugees pose any kind of a security threat at all.
Gotten an email from a listener named Craig that that addresses a point we haven't talked about yet, although I think Cole kind of alluded to it. And our email address, if you want to join the conversation by email, is nolimits@wfyi.org. Craig writes, I am still a bit confused about the preference given to religious minorities coming from the Middle East. As of now, are Christians and other religious minorities from the Middle East allowed to travel, or are they subject to the 90 days as well? On top of that, how is it that the people who propose this are against the ideas of affirmative action when it comes to minorities in the USA, but not with refugees from the Middle East? Sounds like there are some legal principles involved there, so I'll throw that one to Rachel first.
Well, I don't know if I can really answer why they're against affirmative action, but they're okay with this. But what we know now is that they would be eligible for a waiver, but they're not strictly allowed. So religious minorities would have to apply for a waiver to come in during this 90-day ban, but would not be strictly just admissible as a religious minority. And they'd have to be suffering persecution, which if they're a refugee, they are. But I think they'd have to demonstrate that. Part of the problem right now is that the executive orders are just so vague and we're not getting any directive on them. So it's hard for us to know how to advise our clients, advise the immigrant community about what's going on, because there's varied definitions and things that are going on that we just can't seem to make heads or tails of sometimes.
As a practical matter, how do you test faith? I mean, what prevents someone from saying, I'm a Christian, just to get moved to the head of the line?
Yeah, I'm not sure. I mean, I've been in interviews, asylum interviews, where they've asked them questions about, you know, if they claim to be a Christian, okay, well, how would people know you're Christian? What's the head of your church's name? Things like that, which you should know theoretically if you're that. But I don't know. I don't know if we have a good answer to that.
Cole?
I don't know if the administration has a very good understanding of that either, because it's unclear what these religious minorities would be, because there's plenty of religious persecution happening across the world. We could talk about the Rohingya in Burma. We could talk about the Yazidis. Which groups is he going to select? Is he going to handpick them? And why one group over the other? If you're a persecuted individual, whether based on religion, your political views, your gender identity, you're a refugee internationally.
Got another email question from a listener named Marcia, and again, our email address is nolimits@wfyi.org. She writes, it is my understanding that the ACLU has filed an injunction against this executive order. Could your guest please discuss? Actually, they don't get to file an injunction, but that's been the practical effect. They've challenged it legally, right,
right,
Rachel?
Just before I came in here, I checked, and there's been 13 lawsuits filed across the country. The first one was filed on behalf of an Iraqi translator who was detained upon entry. And so the judge stopped the deportation of those people, but it has not fully enjoined the whole order yet.
And at this point, it looks like there's been some clarification on special immigrant visa holders, which would be this gentleman. specifically individuals from Iraq and Afghanistan that had aided the U.S. forces over there and then have been granted this special immigrant visa. It appears they'll be able to travel.
If you are just joining us, we are talking about President Trump's controversial executive order banning immigration from seven heavily Muslim countries. And we're talking also about his rhetoric regarding immigration and the policies of this new administration. My guests are Cole Varga of Exodus Refugee Immigration, Professor Elizabeth Cullen Dunn at Indiana University, and Rachel Van Tile, immigration attorney with Neighborhood Christian Legal Clinic. I am John Kroll. You're listening to No Limits. Please stay with us. Welcome back to No Limits. I am John Kroll, director of Franklin College's Pulliam School of Journalism, publisher of the StateHouseFile.com, and your host. We're talking today on No Limits about President Trump's controversial immigration ban and about his policies regarding immigration in general. If you'd like to join the conversation, please give us a buzz at 866-476-3881. You can send us an email at nolimits@wfyi.org. You can find us on Facebook at No Limits WFYI or on Twitter at WFYI. My guests are Cole Varga of Exodus Refugee Immigration, Elizabeth Cullen Dunn, she's a professor of geography and international studies at Indiana University, and Rachel Van Tile, an immigration attorney with Neighborhood Christian Legal Clinic. Got an email question from a listener named Ben who says, Trump's travel ban extends to countries that have no known record of its citizens carrying out a terrorist attack on the United States. The remaining four countries that Trump refused to ban are all countries that either Trump or the United States have strong economic or business ties with. Yet these are all countries from which its nationals have successfully carried out terrorist attacks against us. It seems to me that the media have not spent much time discussing this or pushing Sean Spicer about it. Why?
Well, I think it's true that the United States has a long-standing history of ties to the Saudi government. In fact, the House of Saud was so close to the Bush administration, both Bush administrations, that the Bush family referred to Prince Bandar as Bandar Bush. Mm-hmm. So that's a long-standing issue that is not related to Trump's business ties directly, but to American foreign policy over the last 25 years. And it's also true that the Saudi government has been very active in promulgating a very fundamentalist version of Islam called Wahhabism. And it's been very active in pushing that around the Muslim world. So the reason why we don't ban Saudis is, to me, a mystery. They have Saudi citizens have killed more Americans on American soil than from any other country. If we really were concerned about national security and really worried about an attack here, we would be banning Saudis. We would be banning Belgians, since all of the attackers in the Paris attacks were either Belgian or French citizens by birth. So this ban is not necessarily about improving national security, and it's not targeting the countries that are producing the danger.
We are talking about immigration here on No Limits. If you want to join the conversation, you can do what a listener named Paul has done and give us a call at 866-476-3881. Paul, welcome to the program.
Thank you so much for taking my call.
Certainly. What's on your mind?
Well, I belong to a church that started a few years ago, and we partnered with Exodus Refugee to help bring over some folks from the Congo and some other African countries. These folks have been, some of them had been living in refugee camps for, you know, up to 12 years. There were children that are in our group now that were born in refugee camps. You know, and as far as taking the refugee route in order to get in to commit terrorism, that just doesn't seem likely to me. But my second point is that from a Christian standpoint, it really saddens me when I see people in a position of power that claim Christian values, but yet try to shut down things like immigration. You know, we're called as Christians to help people and to welcome them and to treat them as brothers and to sacrifice and give of our lives to them, and prioritizing Christians to come into the country is anathema to Christianity and the teachings of Jesus. So thank you.
Thanks very much for the call and the comment, Paul.
Thank you.
Certainly. So this raises, because it's something we haven't talked about here, I mean, one of the other arguments that we have heard from President Trump and his supporters is that really not all that many people were affected. I mean, they throw around a number of like 109 people were detained or something like that. Is that number accurate? And if it isn't, could we talk about how many people have been affected by this? Cole, I'll start with you.
Well, I think what he's trying to refer to there is this this temporary travel ban on the seven countries. The number of people actually being affected by this is, in reality, much greater. So I can tell you, for example, we were expecting next week to be at the airport here in Indianapolis welcoming a young Syrian family of three. We have no idea when and if they'll ever be able to come now. So they may be stuck in a camp after being told they would have a chance at a new life here in the U.S., after being told they were coming next week to make a home in Indianapolis. Their future is uncertain. They're now stuck in this camp. So that's one of, I'm sure, hundreds of stories that will play out here in the next 120 days and perhaps years, as long as the Syrian ban stays intact.
How transparent has this process been? And I'll ask either Rachel or Cole or Elizabeth if you have insights in it, because I know, for example, the ban on Syrian refugees here in Indiana, some of the spokespeople from the state insisted that there were no families immediately in the pipeline, when in fact there were people who were ready to arrive here and had to be rerouted to Connecticut, if I recall correctly, Cole.
Yes, so that was the week of Pence's directive, or whatever we want to call it. We were expecting a Syrian family, and before we had time to decide or to realize what our legal rights were in protecting this family, we decided to get in touch with our friends in Connecticut and divert that family to Connecticut. They were then welcomed by another resettlement agency out there, as well as Governor Malloy, who welcomed them with open arms. But in the meantime, there were several other – in December, Catholic Charities here in town welcomed another family. In January, February, we welcomed some families. In total, Exodus has welcomed about 225 Syrians in the past 2 years. So luckily, we took quick action with the ACLU and got a preliminary injunction here in federal court in February 2016.
You know, one of the things when we think about people affected, we have to think about the people who will be stuck now in camps indefinitely with nowhere to go. I spent about 18 months in a camp, and I can tell you it damages your health. You watch while your children can't be educated. You can't work or build a career. I mean, it's being permanently temporary. And the average length of stay in a camp now is over 17 years.
Rachel.
And I think that number of 110 people, you have to remember that those were people that were actually allowed to board a plane. So those were people that were in midair when this announcement was made and then were detained. That doesn't include people that maybe received extra scrutiny. I've heard of stories of, you know, people being questioned for 4 hours and then released. And not to mention all the people in those countries that were expecting to come here but were not permitted to board a plane to the United States because their visas had been revoked.
Got an email from our regular listener, Kenny. And Kenny writes, again, our email address is nolimits@wfyi.org. Kenny writes, in a number of cases, refugees and also Canadian citizens attempting to enter the U.S. for the Women's March were asked their attitude regarding Donald Trump. If they refused to express support, they were turned away. The Canadian case was well documented. This is in direct violation of the bedrock fundamental American principle, freedom of speech, and from religious coercion. It is dangerously within the realm of fascist socio-political practice. Please comment. Is that legal, Rachel?
I would say it's not legal if that's what's happening. I haven't seen that documentation, so I don't know that I can really comment on it other than to say if that was happening, that was certainly illegal.
So let me say this, because there are a lot of horror stories floating around about this. And while some of them apparently are true, many others, it turns out, are not. Most of the focus is on Donald Trump here and his administration. But what are some of the other avenues? Who are the other parties who could be, you know, have a hand in alleviating some of this tremendous national and now international tension? Cole.
Well, I think you can look to governors and local leaders who are either taking a stand or leaving their voices and their opinions ambiguous at the moment because they're waiting to see how all this plays out. But I would encourage our elected officials to make a decision quickly on how they feel about this ban, this executive order, because it's the first couple of weeks here, and we're going to really define ourselves and how we treat the other in the coming weeks and how we respond to this travel ban. I was out there at the airport on Sunday night and saw a lot of people come together to support the immigrant, the Muslim community, the refugee community, and it was really inspiring to see Hoosiers out there fighting for each other.
We're talking about President Trump's immigration ban here on No Limits. If you want to join the conversation, you can do what Duncan has done and call us at 866-476-3881. Duncan, welcome to the program.
Hey, thanks for having me, Don.
Certainly. What's on your mind?
I just wanted to say a couple things. I wanted to start and say I'm super proud to work at a place that has committed to giving all of our profits to Exodus Refugee tomorrow, Wildwood Market. I hope that's okay to do. But also,
thanks so much.
I just wanted to kind of this conversation has been great, and so I want this not to reflect on this conversation, but rather the national conversation. And that I want us to continue to focus on all these all these actions as being done by the administration, because I'm afraid that when President Trump is inevitably impeached, that Pence and Bannon and everybody are going to try and distance themselves from him. And it's kind of like they are opening with the mile, and then they're going to ask for an inch later with things that are just as evil. But they're going to be separate from the sensationalism of Trump, and I think it's going to be more subtle. And so I just want us to be able to, kind of look at it in that sense.
Thanks very much for the call for the comment, Duncan. So, is there? I mean, there also is a theory that, and there's no other way to put this, that the president makes these inflammatory gestures to distract attention from other areas. Do you think that there is any legitimacy to that thought? That, you know, for example, he's focusing all of our attention on immigration, and we're not paying attention to perhaps his ties to Russia or the fact that he hasn't released his tax returns or any of those other things. Everyone's looking at everyone else.
There's so many horrible things going on simultaneously. It's hard to say that one is a distraction from another. But I think it's really important for us to keep thinking about how this is going to change America's role in the world. And one of the things that's happening now is as we're pulling back and refusing to work with our partners in Europe and at the United Nations to come up with a global system to manage this enormous upswing in people, we're walking away from our ability to help decide how that's going to happen. And I think that is going to cause us grave political problems down the road. We're inflaming our allies. We're trashing relationships with countries like Australia, where we had an agreement to take about 1,250 refugees from Nauru, which is where Australia has been holding refugees. So this is a kind of political gesture which is going to have long-term consequences for our allies in the world and for our ability to influence national security.
We've gotten a comment from a listener named Bethany via Facebook. And again, our Facebook address is No Limits, WFYI. Bethany writes, I've been seeing a lot of people commenting online about the immigration ban, saying things like, America is for Americans, a statement that I take a lot of issue with considering how our country was founded. I'm interested to hear your panelists discuss this ultra-nationalist viewpoint and the refutation of this argument. Thank you. Who wants to take a crack at that one first?
Well, I'll just mention briefly that we've been through things like this before in our history, and this looks like incredibly sad moment, of course. We've been through, of course, the Japanese internment camps. We've been through anti-Irish sentiment, anti-Italian sentiment, right? And now I hope we get over it soon because, as we've seen with, well, just the Irish and Italian communities as an example, they are now embedded and became woven into the fabric of American culture. We celebrate St. Paddy's Day more than Ireland does. Mm-hmm. We have Italian restaurants all over the place and celebrate Italian heritage. So I hope someday we'll get to a point when we're celebrating Syrian heritage in that same way.
So go ahead.
You know, we've done this before and we've done it really successfully. We took in over 2 million Vietnamese refugees during the course of the Vietnamese War. We've taken in Cubans from the Mariel boatlift. And in each of those cases, there was a large public outcry, real worries that, you know, communists would sneak in as refugees and cause trouble. And in fact, what happened was nothing. The end result of this is a richer fabric to American life and a real improvement in restaurants.
How much of this, I mean, when we think about American history, we tend to think about really, you know, slavery, for example, has been called America's original sin. Less attention is focused on what has been our historic unease with immigration. I mean, even one of the things that came out of the dispute over this past election is the fact that, you know, through much of the 19th century and the first part of the 20th century, the House of Representatives, which helped shape how the Electoral College is apportioned, grew in proportion to the population. It was capped in the late 1920s, in part because of fears about immigration, the waves of immigration that Cole was just alluding to. Is some of it we don't understand our own history in regard to immigration and its impact on us? I'm going to start with you, Elizabeth, because I'd like a scholar's perspective first.
Yeah, I think we see the same pattern happening all the time, that there's a wave of immigration and then there's a kind of nativist backlash to it. And then within a few years, it's as if these people had been here all along. I remember that my grandmother came as a Jew and from Poland in the early part of the 20th century and was wildly discriminated against. And today, the idea of discriminating against someone for being Jewish or Polish seems quite foreign, I think. So we're in this cycle again, and somehow we never seem to realize that we've been here before, that we're doing the same thing again. And I think it would be helpful for us to look back historically and think about why it is that we have these nativist backlashes when we know that we can assimilate people really successfully.
What's really missing from this conversation has been the humanity of it. You know, we talk about Syrians and we talk about Iraqis and these different groups, and it's all in the abstract from both the media and from our elected officials. But really, these are humans. These are moms and dads. These are mostly children, in fact. Out of the 1,000 refugees we've welcomed this past year, about half of them are kids. So we can't just abstractly say we don't want Syrians here. We have to really come to terms with we don't want children who have fled war here. We don't want farmers and doctors and lawyers who have had their homes destroyed by bombs to be here. That's what it actually means.
Gotten an email question from a listener named Brittany. Our email address is nolimits@wfyi.org. Brittany writes, what are some practical ways people can support refugees in Indiana, and what are the biggest needs for Exodus and NCLC and their clients right now?
Well, right now we are asking three things of people. We need advocacy with our elected officials, of course, to make sure they know that the Hoosier State is a welcoming state and that we support refugees being welcomed into our community. Second, of course, we're fundraising to ensure that we have enough funds to prepare to meet the needs of all those refugees we've welcomed in the past months.
And we'll get to the third point after the break. We're talking about immigration here on No Limits. My guests are Cole Varga, Elizabeth Cullen Dunn, and Rachel Van Tile. I am John Krall. You're listening to No Limits. Please stay with us. Well, Welcome back to No Limits. I am John Krall, director of Franklin College's Pulliam School of Journalism, publisher of the StateHouseFile.com, and your host. We're talking today about immigration, specifically President Trump's executive order banning immigration from certain countries. My guests are Cole Varga. He is with Exodus Refugee Immigration. Professor Elizabeth Cullen Dunn, who is Associate Professor of Geography and International Studies at Indiana University, and Rachel Van Tile, who is an immigration attorney with Neighborhood Christian Legal Clinic. Before we went to the break, I let you get through two of three ways that that Exodus could be helped. Could you recap them real quickly and then go to the third? And then they also asked how they could help NCLC.
Sure, thanks. So firstly, advocacy with your elected officials. I want, no matter your opinion, reach out to your elected officials. Tell them how you feel about this executive order. Tell them that you're a Hoosier and you're part of a welcoming community here in Indiana. Second, we're fundraising, of course, to make sure that we can provide the services that we promised to the refugees that have already arrived in Indiana. And finally, we're taking donated items, winter items such as hats and gloves and coats, scarves, and also Indigo bus passes to get people that can commute around the city to get to their jobs.
How do we help NC? How do people help NCLC?
Yeah, so I think one of the great ways is just signing up to be a volunteer. Sometimes we just need people to help us do copying and filing. It's been a really long week, and I'm kind of behind on everything. We're stretched thin, but we're committed to supporting our clients. So if you're interested in volunteering, you can always go to our website, and there's a tab there that says volunteer. And always, we also would welcome donations as we continue to look for ways to support the refugee and undocumented communities.
Could I ask both of you after the show, so that it is easy, to go to our Facebook page and just post the links to your organizations and how they may be able to make contributions or where people can get more information?
Absolutely.
We've gotten an email question from a listener named Aaron. Our email address is nolimits@wfyi.org. Aaron writes, "It's my understanding that this ban also affects U.S. green card holders. Can you talk about how this works and why it's allowed?" Is that the case, Rachel?
It's a little unclear. That's like my favorite answer is I'm not sure. But I think that if they're still outside of the country and they hold a passport from one of the original seven countries, they will not be permitted to enter the United States right now unless they qualify for some sort of waiver upon entry. But it's, like I said, it's very unclear. We're not sure exactly what that looks like. They would need to be processed through border protection with a waiver in order to enter the U.S.
Elizabeth, you study these issues, and in fact, you have a particular expertise connected with IU and have founded kind of a pioneering effort that I'd like for you to talk a little bit while you answer this question. What is it? Because with controversial issues like this, often more heat than light is generated. What are the things that Americans are missing about this discussion right now that actually might generate understanding?
Yeah, here's the most important thing people need to know. This is not just a pause that people can wait out in many cases. People who are being prioritized for resettlement in the United States are doing so in many cases because their lives are in danger. I have a student from when I was at the University of Colorado, and he defected from the Assad army. He was drafted into the army in Syria. He didn't want to serve, so he defected. In Turkey, he was in danger of being killed by Assad supporters for having defected, or by rebel forces for having been in the Assad army. There's no place for him to go that's safe. And if someone like him has to wait 4, 5, 6 months, another year, their lives are in jeopardy. And I think that what's really important to note is that if you sign on to a ban, you sign on to putting those people in real danger.
We are talking about immigration here on No Limits. If you want to join the conversation, please give us a buzz at 866-476-3881. Ali, welcome to the program.
Thank you so very much. I immigrated from Iraq in 2012 through the special immigration visa, and I was held by Exodus to resettle in Indianapolis, and they really did a great job. They welcomed me and my family and helped me to, start a new life here in Indianapolis. I don't know what the new, the new refugees or the new immigrants from Iraq and other countries can do without Exodus and other resettlement agencies. So they help people to start a new life. So I really want to say thank you very much to Exodus and other resettlement agencies. I have a question about my immigration status here in the United States, because I'm only a green card holder now. There's a rumor that is spreading around the Iraqi community and other communities is that because Iraqis now on ban, that will affect the green card holders when they apply to citizenship. It will be maybe longer, or they will be under like a screening process, and even the Iraqis who have a U.S. citizenship, some people say that they are also banned from returning back to the United States. So these rumors that are, spreading around are, making me and my family really worried, and I really want to know what's my future here in this country, because, I have a family, I have kids, and one of my kids is a U.S. citizen. So I really want some clarification.
Well, we'll try to get an answer for you as best we can. Thank you for calling in and sharing your story, and we wish the best for you and your family. Thanks very much for the call. Rachel?
Thank you very much.
Yeah, so what we understand now is that citizenship applications that are in process will not be held, that they will make decisions on those. What we're unclear about is whether or not we can file new applications for people from that country during this 90-day ban. Certainly, if you are a U.S. citizen and you leave this country and reenter, we've been told that as long as you reenter with your U.S. passport, that you should be cleared to enter the United States, as long as you don't try to reenter with another country's passport. But that goes to kind of a larger point, I think, that he says that clients are confused, clients are scared, and we're just trying to get really true information out there. Also, all the banned countries, if we have applications for asylum pending or applications for other immigration relief, those are going to be put on hold for at least 90 days while we wait for, more direction or potentially even a longer ban or bar or whatever word we want to use there.
Well, I'm trying to think how I want to frame this, because as I was listening to Ali, and I've talked with other people. I suspect you have talked to many, many more who are part of the refugee community, or not even refugees. They just have some immigrant experience or are visitors to this country, and they're now expressing fear or at the very least worry. I mean, when we did the show on Tuesday, a woman from Britain who'd lived here for 30 years calls in and said she was scared about where things were going. What are people telling you, the folks that you work with? I mean, what has the impact been on them, Cole?
I would say that they are afraid, and it's, again, the word of the day is uncertainty. This order is only a few pages long, and there's immigration is such a complex issue. It deserves a little bit more clarification, and hopefully we get that in the coming weeks. But what I'm hearing is people are, of course, afraid of their future here. They're afraid of not only their future, but the future of their family members that are still overseas that they were expecting to receive here as part of the refugee program or other immigration programs. So not only that, I think when we have someone in the White House who is implementing these types of decrees, these executive orders, what is that doing? How is that enabling people locally? You know, are Muslim friends, are Muslim students that are in school safe? Are they being bullied? I've heard a couple of instances of that happening, and it's just so unfortunate that people are now kind of taking a pass here because they feel like it's okay to be discriminating against Muslims.
gotten an email from a listener named, and I hope I'm pronouncing this right, Halima. And our email address is nolimits@wfyi.org. Halima writes, "Thank you very much for facilitating this conversation. One of your guests briefly mentioned the internment of Japanese immigrants and American citizens. As a second-generation African-American Muslim, I have growing concern that the Islamophobic discrimination being directed towards Muslim immigrants will eventually be turned towards all Muslims, including American citizens. I've heard that the statutes which legalized internment camps in the past still exist today. Is this true? If so, is it possible we could see history repeat itself?" Rachel.
Gosh, I have no idea if those are still in the books or not. But I think that we have to, I mean, one thing that was very heartening to me this weekend was to see all the protests of people of different creeds and, you know, colors and races, and just everybody was out there saying, this isn't represent who we are. And I think that hopefully we can continue to see that and a pushback on things that would cause a repetition of history here.
We've got a lot of calls, emails, and all that. I'm going to try in the very few minutes we have left to get through as many of them as possible, but I'm going to ask our callers to be very, very brief. Graham, welcome to the program.
Hi, thanks for taking my call.
Certainly. What's on your mind?
I own a local business that, like a lot of businesses in Indy at the moment, is sending some of our proceeds to Exodus Refugee, and I've witnessed losing customers in spite of that, without mentioning the travel ban or without mentioning President Trump at all. I'm still watching how divided the issue is. So I wanted to just give the panelists a chance. I kind of feel your pain that the moment your organizations are receiving the most attention is also the moment that your issue is most politicized. So I wanted to give you a chance to tell us about anything exciting or any achievements that you were doing right before this crisis hit, because I know that you would still be around if we weren't in the middle of a crisis. So if there's anything exciting or that you'd like to brag about for a second, I'd love to give you that opportunity.
Thanks very much for the call, Graham. Start with you, Cole.
Yeah, thanks for the call. Well, I can tell you that Indianapolis has really stepped up, as they did last year during the Pence directive, and as they are now doing in the face of this executive order, that we have made a lot of new friends, and the refugee community has made a lot of new allies in the past week, not just at the airport, but we've had spikes in donations and in online Amazon gift lists that we have. We have people sending us coats from all over the place. I got an email this morning from a woman in Juneau, Alaska, that said she wanted to mail a package of donated clothes to us to help the refugees here in Indianapolis. So it's really been heartening to see the allies and the people that will stand with refugees during this time.
Elizabeth.
Yeah, we're gathering a group of people at IU who work on refugee studies. We have people who have done fieldwork in Uganda, in Kakuma Camp in Kenya, in the Republic of Georgia. So we're starting to get a group of people who understand the experience of displacement and who weigh in on global policy on displacement.
Super fast.
Yes, super fast.
I just want to, you know, the clinic is working at expanding our reach beyond central Indiana. We've now opened an intake site in Evansville. So we're hoping to get out there and reach even some of these communities that maybe don't have as much legal representation. So
we've got an email from a listener named Michelle. Our email address is nolimits@wfyi.org. Michelle writes, "I always question the fact that when people speak about immigration, they talk about the United States as though we are in the exact same situation economically, socially, and environmentally as we were back in the 1800s. America is very different now. Opportunities are not as great, and we have a lot more international competition. I also find that immigrant communities are not as integrating as they once were. Immigrant communities tend to be more insular and remain as a separate group with their own culture, their own language, and customs more than we have seen in the past." Is this true, Elizabeth?
And that is exactly what has been said since, you know, the first immigrants arrived in America. We heard that about Poles in Chicago at the turn of the century. We've heard it about Lithuanian communities. We've heard it about almost every community that's arrived in America. And it's de facto not true. They do integrate. It's a period which takes a longer period of time, sometimes a generation or two generations. The other thing I want to talk about is this notion that refugees steal jobs. Unemployment in this country is as low as it has been in a very long time. It's like right around 4%. Here in Indiana, we're at 5% unemployment. Usually, if you dip below 3%, it starts to make the economy contract because there's not enough labor. So it's not true that refugees are taking jobs that otherwise would go to Americans. They're coming in, creating markets, and adding to the economic base of this country.
Gotten an email question from a listener named Nick. It says, in addition to the refugee ban, President Trump also made sweeping changes to domestic immigration enforcement, making it easier for local law enforcement to collude with immigration and customs enforcement and detain and deport non-criminal immigrants. Would your panelists comment on the state of local immigration enforcement, including suggesting how Mayor Hogsett and IMPD can make the city safer for our immigrant community, i.e. making Indianapolis a sanctuary city, as Cincinnati recently did? Rachel.
Yes. So sanctuary city, just for as a definition, is a city that will not cooperate with DHS or Department of Homeland Security in detaining immigrants. So I think if Indianapolis wants to make a step to being a sanctuary city, that's one thing. But I definitely think we can continue to become a welcoming city. That's an initiative that was started by Mayor Ballard. It's been picked up by Mayor Hogsett. And we're working on policies that would create a more welcoming Indianapolis.
I'm going to ask this because this conversation, we've got so many of these things backed up. I'd like to ask the indulgence of the three of you to see if you would continue the conversation after we go off the air on our Facebook page. And I'd ask our listeners to start directing their attention to our Facebook page so that which is No Limits WFYI. So that this discussion, because I can tell there are a lot of questions left. I want to get one last one in, though, from a listener named Jeremy, who sent us an email. It said, please repeat guest contact and website information. He and I think many others would love to volunteer to show the world that Indianapolis supports refugees. So each one of you, if you've got a URL, real quickly, I'll start with Cole.
Sure. It's exodusrefugee.org.
Exodusrefugee.org. Elizabeth.
I'm at the School for Global and International Studies at IU Bloomington.
Okay. Rachel.
Yeah. NCLegalClinic.org.
NCLegalClinic.org. Well, I feel like we could have done at least another 3 hours on this. I'm really, really grateful. I know you rearranged your schedules to come in so we could talk about this while people cared about this issue a great deal. I would like to thank my guests, Cole Varga of Exodus Refugee Immigration, Elizabeth Cullen Dunn, she's Associate Professor of Geography and International Studies at Indiana University, and Rachel Van Tile, an immigration attorney with Neighborhood Christian Legal Clinic. I am John Kroll. You have been listening to No Limits. Thank you for joining us.
No Limits is a production of 90.1 WFYI Public Radio, Indianapolis. Executive Producer, Michelle Johnson. Producer, Shannon Cagle. Interactive Media Coordinator, Scott McAllister. Technical producers Cedric Freeman and Chris Flood, and board engineer Joe Hatcher. Abby Terzini screens our calls. No Limits is made available through IPBS, Indiana's public broadcasting stations.